You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and on the Breakfast Grill this morning is Alan George, author of the book Syria, Neither Bread Nor Freedom, a visiting research fellow at King's College London. He's also well known for his research on the Middle East. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
I wanted to begin with your book, which was published in 2003, some time ago now, but recounts an extraordinary moment in modern Syrian history, the moment when reform of an authoritarian system seemed to be on the brink of possibility. It was referred to as the Damascus Spring. I wonder if you could put the current and extraordinarily complex situation in Syria in that perspective, in that frame of a regime attempting to change and then failing to do so.
I think one has to take a pretty brutal approach to this particular regime, the regime now headed by Bashar al-Assad. Previously, of course, it had been headed by his father, Hafez al-Assad. If we go back further, 1963, the Ba'athists seized power in a coup d'etat. There was internal fighting between different wings of the Ba'ath Party, and eventually Hafez al-Assad, the father of the present president, took power in November 1970. Now, it's an extremely authoritarian regime. It's ruled through its secret police agencies, of which there are around 14. They spy on each other, as well as putting fear into the population. But at the core of this regime, which is a very opaque regime, Syrians don't really know what's going on at the center of this regime. But at the core of the regime is the Assad family and their wider community, which is the Alawi community. The Alawi are a sect of Shia Islam who are centered in northwest Syria along the coast. So you've got the family at the center, you've got the Alawi community, who are the most trusted parts of the regime, very heavily involved in the security agencies. Then you have those security agencies, and everything else is really a facade. There's a parliament, there are elections, but everything is fixed so that the president always wins. Now, when Hafez al-Assad died in mid-2000, his son, Bashar, then only 34 years old, took power, and there was this extraordinary roughly six months period that you mentioned, the Damascus Spring, when it seemed that after 40 years of this intense authoritarian regime, it seemed that there was going to be some liberalization, and it seemed that this new young president, educated in the West, an ophthalmologist by profession, it seemed that the system was going to liberalize. There was certainly much more press freedom permitted. People were allowed to meet in forums, normally in people's homes, to discuss political developments, political issues that before would have had them straight into prison and torture. Sadly, in my view, very sadly, after around 6 months, the Damascus Spring turned into a Damascus Winter. The leading dissidents or liberals or oppositionists were arrested, imprisoned, and essentially the regime reverted to type.
In 2002, Assad and his wife were welcomed at Downing Street. There was quite a bit of hope that seemed to frame them, not just as a couple, but as the face of what could have been a new order. In fact, you say, interestingly enough, at the end of your book, the key measure of Bashar al-Assad's performance will be the extent to which he succeeds as midwife to a new order. Your book was written in 2003. Were you still hopeful by the time you'd completed the manuscript, that there were still possibilities? I mean, your book is replete with, names of individuals, filmmakers and directors and writers and poets, that called on change.
Well, yeah, the book came out in 2003. And of course, by then, the Damascus Spring had turned into the Damascus Winter. So a lot of the optimism of the first months of Bashar al-Assad's presidency had evaporated by then. I think there was still reason for hope. There was a notion that perhaps Bashar, as a young newcomer, would have to consolidate his position against a much more conservative, authoritarian old guard, the people who had been around his father. And there was a hope, and it wasn't just my hope, it was the hope amongst Syrian liberals, that if Bashar could consolidate his position, he would then move forward with a liberalization that was genuinely close to his heart. Those hopes have been dashed. It turns out, I think, and I say it cautiously because, as I mentioned before, this is a very opaque regime and nobody really understands its most inner workings. But it seems to me that Bashar is not a powerful personality. He's by all accounts, he's very indecisive. It seems that he never had the political determination really to liberalize. It was something he might have gone along with had he not come up against opposition within his regime amongst his Baathist colleagues. Certainly there was opposition to what he was doing from harder line individuals, but he never commanded the regime in the way that his father had. His father, Hafez, really was the power in Syria. What he wanted happened. With Bashar, it was not like that. There was an indecision around Bashar. I don't think it's simply old guard versus new guard, which is what we all tended to think in the first 2-3 years of his presidency. As it turns out, Bashar is, you know, the old guard is, or the young guard, you could say, is actually old guard. At the center is a president who's indecisive. That's the big issue.
So on one hand, we have the regime is authoritarian, it's opaque, as you say, but there was also a functioning Syrian society. And that's what I was struck by when reading your book, that Syrian society as such continued and seemed to be quite vibrant, or at least had the potential for that kind of vibrance, and it continued for some time. What was in where were the seeds that created the civil war that we have seen and been so devastating?
I think it's important to take a historical view of Syria. This is a country at a trading crossroads between Europe, Asia, and Africa, historically a great trading nation open to ideas from the outside. It's a country that, following independence from France in the late 40s, had a functioning democracy. It had real parliamentary elections. There were a succession of military coups, but the parliamentary life did actually revert following military coups. The story since 1963 and the Baathist takeover is very different to the story of Syria in the 1950s, early 1950s in particular. So there was a... There is a Syrian society which is open to the outside, to ideas from the outside, by dint of the country's geographical location. And there's a history of democratic activity with all that goes with that, a press, a free press during the 1950s and so on. So, yes, Syria was Syria. The Baathists came, imposed their system on top of it, but in private... I used to go to Syria in the 1970s as a student. In private, people would criticize the regime in a way that, had they done so publicly, would have put them straight into prison. So there was always a free-thinking current within Syria. Also, of course, there Islamism has always been one of many elements in the Syrian political situation, if you like. So the Muslim Brotherhood, in particular, has always been significant in Syria, and in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, of course, launched a rebellion against the Baathist regime, for which the people paid very, very heavily. The destruction of the city of Hama in 1982 was the consequence of that. But that Muslim Brotherhood-led rebellion didn't only involve the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, non-sectarian intellectuals also were part of that process. So the Damascus Spring of 2000 extraordinary though it was in a sense a continuation of trends that had existed before, that had never been destroyed. There was always a vibrant undercurrent, if you like, some Islamist, some not at all Islamist. Ba'athists did not destroy all that.
The Middle East is an area of tremendous intervention in the 20th century from Western powers or other powers, regional, ambitious powers as well. What external forces help precipitate the Syrian civil war that really was the consequence of which we're seeing right now?
Well,
the short answer, please.
The short answer is many, and it's a very, very interesting topic. I might say a book has just come out by Christopher Phillips entitled The Battle for Syria, which is a very interesting book and looks at the external influences on the uprising. It's often the narrative of the uprising has often simply been the oppressed Syrian people rose up in March 2011 against an oppressive regime. In the context of the wider Arab Spring. Now, that's true so far as it goes, but this new book by Christopher Phillips actually takes a look at the external players, particularly Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, Russia now, that had a stake in this uprising from very early on and shaped it to a very considerable degree. It's a very important dimension of what has happened that has not received the attention it deserves.
We're going to come back to that right after this. On the Breakfast Grill with me this morning is Alan George, author of the book Syria, Neither Bread Nor Freedom, a visiting research fellow at King's College London. Next up, we speak about the future of Syria on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, who just joined us. I'm speaking to Alan George, author of the book Syria, Neither Bread Nor Freedom, a visiting research fellow at King's College London and a well-known name in Middle East politics, at least in observing it and writing about it. Alan, we left off with talking about the external forces that have come to play. In fact, that's the story that we hear every day on our television screens, Russia bombing, question of American intervention. How do we start to understand the current situation? Because, as you said, it's an extraordinarily complex one.
It's such a big question. I mean, I think it's extremely important to understand the extent of the fragmentation of Syria. We're talking not only about the Islamic State militia, which controls the northeast, the Kurdish militias, plural, in the north. There's Al-Qaeda-type militias that control most of the province of Idlib, to the southwest of Aleppo, and are active around Damascus in the south. The regime controls the major cities, Damascus, Homs, Hama, and now Aleppo. But within each of those categories, there is fragmentation. I mean, the Syrian army now is not what it was, for example. Some of the units are quasi-independent. Within Idlib province, there are hundreds of militias, actually, some very local, some almost gangs, some much more organized. So the question of where Syria is going to go, it's hard to imagine any short-term coherent plan that can put that fragmentation, that can nullify that fragmentation and turn Syria back into a unified state, particularly when these outside players have such large stakes in the situation.
Alan, was Syria a unified state precisely because of the power, the authority and dictatorial power of the Ba'athist regime? I mean, are we looking at one of those countries emerging out of the Second World War, out of colonialism, that really shouldn't have been a country, that, you know, in some sense, in fact, required the strong hand of, a dictator to hold it together? And once you didn't have that, it was just destined to fall apart.
It's a big argument, and I think what you're saying is arguable. The territory on which Syria sits was, of course, historically part of the Ottoman Empire up to the First World War, and that eastern Mediterranean area, which now comprises Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel and the Palestinian territories was simply known as Sham. It was the Arabic name, Greater Syria. And if there was an identity, it was an identity that related to that region as a whole. After the First World War, the British and French carved it up into Syria. The French, in turn, carved Syria into Lebanon and Syria. The British carved the southern part of Greater Syria into Transjordan, which became the Kingdom of Jordan, and Palestine, which became Israel, and now the Palestinian territories. So there, yes, these are artificial entities, but that doesn't mean there is no Syrian identity. It's a process, I think. And before the Ba'athist dictatorship started in 1963, there was, I mentioned before, a period of parliamentary democracy, albeit interrupted by a military coup. But in the 50s, very early 60s, Syrian identity developed. It's very hard to say at what point a country becomes viable in the sense of identity, but certainly Syrians felt themselves to be Syrian. Now, that's not to say that there are forces within Syria which make for instability. And it's arguable that a strong center is required, as you say, to hold it together.
There's a lot of talk about what's more important, beating back the Islamic State and its genocidal politics, or regime change and getting rid of Bashar al-Assad, because that will be the start of a solution. Are either ways of framing this argument helpful?
Well, they have to be looked at. I think one can perhaps it's useful to predict what is likely to happen in the relatively short term. I think the Islamic State, and indeed, as you say, their politics are just unspeakable. I think they will be defeated militarily. But of course, the tendency of the Islamic State, that type of view of the region, of the world, is not going to disappear. It was born of a great deal of resentment arising from the invasion of Iraq, of course. So however detestable Islamic State may be, it's extremely important to understand that it is a rational result of political and military developments, particularly in Iraq, which spilled over into Syria. But I think the Islamic State will be defeated militarily by the US-led coalition on the one hand, and the regime and its forces on the other. The second thing I think looks more and more likely is that the regime of Bashar al-Assad will survive, thanks to its alliance with the Russians, who of course are militarily engaged in Syria, and its alliance, long-standing, which started with Bashar's father, Hafez, the alliance with Iran. Now, Iran assists the regime financially, but also militarily, providing weaponry, for example. And very importantly, the Iranian-backed Hezbollah organization, which is based in southern Lebanon, a militant Shia organization, has sent thousands of fighters into Syria to support the regime. Also, the Iraqi government is a Shia-dominated government, which is allied with Iran and with Bashar's regime. And there are Iraqi militia involved in Syria on the regime side. So the military balance is pretty good from the perspective of the Damascus regime. So I think this is a regime that's going to at least continue to hold the main cities and is likely to relatively soon is likely to regain control of northeast Syria, which is now held by Islamic State. This is very important for the regime, not least because those are the areas of Syria's oil fields, and those were an absolutely critical source of income for the regime. Much wider questions surround the north-central province of Idlib, where Islamist militias, oppositionist militias are active and control that province, and the outskirts of Damascus in the south and the southern Syria towards the Jordanian border. It's very hard to predict how that might develop, how the situation there might develop. I suppose it's possible to argue that after the defeat of Islamic State, the regime will turn its attention to those areas. and will perhaps eventually regain control of the country. There's always, of course, the Kurdish North. The Kurds are pretty strong, pretty committed to maintaining what amounts to a quasi-Kurdish state, rather like the Kurdish North of Iraq, where the Kurdistan Regional Government holds sway. As to the regime being a solution, it's extremely hard to imagine this regime, which has now caused such havoc. And let's be clear, the uprising and the regime's response to it, I mean, the regime's response to it is all about essentially the Assad family holding power so that one family and those around it can hold power, that Syrians as a whole, the country as a whole, has had to suffer this extraordinary destruction is pretty appalling. And it's hard to imagine any genuine peace settlement coming about that involves Bashar al-Assad and his regime. Now, I'm not saying they won't be able to reimpose their power through sheer terror, which is, if you like, the traditional way that the Baathists in Syria have held power. But it's not going to be, it's hard to imagine a negotiated, meaningful settlement with the opposition. The opposition will demand, for example, at the very least, some sort of measure of real democracy. This is not a regime that gives real democracy, that's interested in real democracy. And it's not a regime that's going to negotiate itself out of power. So the future, I think, is pretty bleak.
Lastly, Alan, the people, the millions of people who have been displaced, who now live either in camps or in Germany, for instance, do you think there will be a situation where they will return home?
Not in the short run, no. It's one of the grand ironies of recent years that the West invaded Iraq with all the instability that resulted from that, and leading to the creation of Islamic State, which then spills into Syria. The outside interference in this region really triggered these massive flows of migrants, which is now a major political issue right across Europe, not only in Germany. It was a big element in the British vote for Brexit, for Britain to leave the European Union. And this is a long-term phenomenon. The only way that these migrant flows will end is if there is stability and economic growth in the origin areas. And there's really no prospect of that. I think the Syrian and other Middle Eastern migrants who make it to Europe and establish themselves are there for keeps.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I've been speaking to Alan George, author of the book Syria, Neither Bread Nor Freedom, visiting fellow at King's College London, an expert on Middle East politics. I'm Sharad Kutin, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.